I drop.
I know I miss it.
Alrighty, folks. Welcome back to Reptile Ramblings.
What's happening? I'm your host, Brian McDowell, co-hosting as always with
the one and only, well, probably not one and only, but so far one and only, Nate Truax.
Oh, dude, you've been doing it longer than me. Yeah, I'm just a guest host or a co-host, but still, you run the show.
Don't you forget it either.
I'm sorry, I won't. All right, we got a good one for you guys this time. As the title suggests, we're diving into all things Primarchan a bit with our special guest Kay tonight.
Yeah. So while we wait for her to get on, we'll do a little R&R, maybe a little catch up. Your weekend, Bryant?
Well, lovely. I got to spend it with you more than usual, so that's always a plus.
Be careful. You might make your girlfriend jealous.
It's okay. I think you need to have some jealousy here and there. But, you know, it's also, now that it's just the two of us before our guests, we can also finally try and kind of catch up on a tradition of rock, paper, scissoring, and then seeing if we can. Yeah, see if we can... let's fall on that, but see if we can choose a country that we still want to herp in. I mean, there's so many countries in the world, and I know there's plenty of choices we left out on the list. So,
all right,
see what we can. Let's see if we can sync it right this time. I'll let you start the count. I don't know if you want to do 1, 2, 3 or on three.
Okay, let's do on three.
All right.
1, 2, 3. You go.
Okay. So for me, and you know, I've given this a little bit of thought, we're heading to Europe, which is somewhat surprising for me. As I've said before on our one episode, Europe doesn't necessarily enthrall me in terms of herpetofauna. Fauna. They got some good stuff, but I'm going with Portugal. I mean, you have some of your classic European colubrids, like your horse whip snakes. I think Malpelon is up in there. I'm not too sure. I don't think ladder snakes. I could be wrong, and I should have double checked. I think ladder snakes.
I'm hopping on INAT right now to take a look.
Perfect. If they don't, they don't. But if they do, then it just adds more cream to the crop.
Yeah.
And plus, you know, a little bit of that Mediterranean climate they got going on. It's a beautiful country, aesthetically, culturally. So this would be one herping trip where herping wouldn't be the main focal point. I would indulge in just the cultural aspect of it too, as well, and just the history background. And plus, you know, it'd be nice to immerse myself in just Portuguese culture. I've been on and off on trying to learn Portuguese. You know, it's part of the Romantic language group. There's some similarities to Spanish, but it's quite different overall. It's a different discipline.
Yeah. So Malpelon, yeah, they're all over Spain, Portugal. Then they go over into southern France. And it looks like they do kind of get around the Mediterranean coast in northeastern Italy, so close to Genoa, but then they pretty much absent from the rest of Italy until you get to the Balkans, like Croatia and Greece and Bulgaria.
Yeah, and you know, like, to give people context on Malpelon, imagine, you know, kind of a more diesel-sized racer-esque snake that's, you know, rear fang venomous and can neck flare quite a bit. And surprisingly, I forget what paper, but they have relatively complex social structure. I mean, with the male, well, just that, what do you call it, family in general. you know, along with the house snakes and sand snakes, and like Egyptian false cobras, they're all in that same family. They have, I guess, nasal scenting, like they'll scent and mark themselves. And then they also seem to be somewhat territorial, which is atypical for many a serpent. And their courtship behavior, from what I've heard, is pretty complex, with the male actually offering to the female. So some selective mate selectiveness, which is, again, very odd for typical snakes.
Yeah. And I went ahead and looked up ladder snakes as well. They're also found in Portugal and Spain, southern France. And that seems to be the extent of their range.
Well, like I said, more cream to the crop, arguably one of my favorite European colubrids. And also one of the easiest to keep in captivity, because, you know, most of the diet from, there are scientific papers on it, most of the diet, even as a hatchling, is mainly mammals. So they adjust pretty well to captivity with our European laboratory mice diet.
Yeah. Okay, let's see if this works. Get an update of that here. Okay. Let's see if that does the trick. I thought I had the email sent, the link sent. Apparently I didn't. Apparently I sent to the wrong address, probably. So.
Well, as long as no stranger hops on here, we're good.
Hey.
Kay.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Oh, no worries. Welcome to the show. Great to have you.
Yeah, it's good to have you on.
No, I'm happy to be here. Really excited.
So I want to get started off a little bit on how you first got into herps, herpetoculture, and what led to indigo snakes in particular.
Yeah, how did you catch the bug? You know, because this is pretty, for some people looking in, this is kind of a eccentric and eclectic, kind of a hobby slash passion. So I'm just curious, what's your background on all this?
Yeah, definitely. So my parents were always super positive about nature and respecting wildlife and all that. And for whatever reason, I just kind of gravitated it towards particularly roly-polies in my yard and worms. So I used to have little races when I was a kid with the roly-polies, and it was just kind of a gateway drug to reptiles, I guess. And so I kind of gravitated towards snakes because I was kind of the awkward kid, and snakes were kind of the black sheep of the animal world to a lot of people. And my parents really encouraged it. They took me to the zoo. I lived right near DC at the time, so they have a really awesome like reptile exhibit. And we went to Clyde Peeling's Reptiland actually back in like the 90s. So that was pretty cool too.
Nice. And you said, where's your upbringing? You said on the East Coast?
Yeah. I grew up right outside DC. And I'm living in New York now.
Oh, sweet. So are you a big museum junkie as well?
Yeah. Whenever we had people visit, it was always, let's go to all the museums. So it was kind of forced on me to enjoy them. But I kind of took it for granted at the time how awesome it was living in D.C. with all the museum access. But yeah, any opportunity I have to go to, you know, any museums or zoos, I'm all for it now.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to check out the Smithsonian. I mean, highly reputable, so I can't imagine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. And D.C. and New York City has awesome stuff, too, but D.C. is really special. And they're free.
Exactly. I mean, what more can you ask for? I definitely need to have an extended weekend getaway someday out there.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Do they still have that life-size blue whale?
I haven't been in a while, but it was there the last time I was there.
Yeah, I think it's like a kind of like a museum icon, so it probably won't go anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah, I can't imagine it's easy to transport either, so it's probably pretty stuck there.
Yeah. Well, But again, I do want to touch a bit more on the upbringing. You're saying you were kind of the black sheep, so you, that's kind of one way he related to snakes. I mean, they are the unsung heroes, I would think, in my eyes. So it's nice to have more advocates for them, in a sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, it was, I just always really gravitated towards them. I'm not really sure why. One of my favorite books when I was really small was about snakes, so maybe that's kind of what put it in my head early on. When I was first learning to write, I wrote my parents a report on why they should let me have a snake. And I was just flabbergasted when it didn't work, and they still said no, because I worked so hard on it. But but I guess, yeah, just was always an interest of mine, but I'm not really sure exactly how it started.
It's funny when, like, the parents are atypical, or not a, but like, we're the ones that are atypical when the parents are typical, they're just not liking snakes. And you're saying, you know, your folks liked nature, but there's just something intrinsically, I guess, learned or instilled in the older generation, you know, like a good snake is a dead snake, that sort of thing. So that there's still a fear, a hesitation, as it were.
Yeah, definitely. And I was very fortunate that both of my parents were not like that at all. They always instilled that, like, you know, all animals in nature have a purpose, and we shouldn't hate them just because they're not, you know, typically cute or cool or, you know, whatever, like, not a tiger, but it's still a valuable creature.
Which, I mean, is a better standpoint than other folks. You know, they seem to have like a neutral negative stance for snakes, which is better than most folks having a very negative stance on snakes.
Right. Yeah. I think a lot of it too was my parents grew up up north, and a lot of the, you know, like good snake is a dead snake mentality comes from where there are a lot of venomous snakes, I feel like. And I think people from the Northeast aren't as prejudiced against them just because they aren't as, you know, quote unquote.
I mean, they wiped them out early on, so there's not even that much of them
that's
around.
True too.
So,
yeah,
so I can see why. So, I mean, that's fantastic. So, I'm curious, how did you get along in getting into the captive side of things? You know, what started you off in your captive career?
So, I was, you know, living in apartments and whatnot where you aren't allowed to have them for the longest time, and I was finally just, about 3 or 4 years ago, able to get my own captive snake. But to kind of fill the void in the meantime, I actually volunteered at a local reptile rescue in the area. And so I got a lot of hands-on experience with just the rescues coming in, and we got, you know, a little bit of everything. And that was a really awesome experience. And I still work with them a lot now. And I have some foster fails of my own. So, but none of my indigos, but, I have like a little ball python that, you know, sob story kind of thing that, so he's mine now and got a beardy. He actually just woke up from brumation today. So that was exciting.
Oh, wow. How long was he down and out for?
A good while. He went down, I think about mid-November, maybe earlier than that. It started getting cold here pretty early this year. So went down a little early.
Sweet. I like that how you kind of just took cues from the animal and just kind of adjusted to the animals to let them, you know, bunker down. And plus it helps on food costs.
Oh yeah.
That's yeah, always my beardies.
Oh yeah. My beardie's the highest maintenance animal I have. And it's, you know, I love him to death, but it's nice to have a little break. Most complex diet, all that. So
this is slightly why I'm partial to snakes. There's many a lizard species I do love and probably love to keep, but They do make it easy for you. I won't lie.
Yeah,
in some
yeah,
aspects.
Definitely.
Maybe not particularly with your kind of snakes that we can get into.
Yeah. But you know, animals aren't as bad as people credit them for, but you know, they're definitely higher maintenance than my little ball python.
Okay, piggybacking just one more thing to the rescue. What was probably the most common herp you would see, like, let me guess, like a red ear slider or
yeah,
Sultanas. Oh really?
Yeah, red ear sliders by far. We actually got a call on Christmas Day asking to take in a red eared slider. So we get, I would say, at least like very, very minimum 5 calls a week for red-eared sliders. And it's really unfortunate, but we just can't take in that many. They require so much space. And when it's so cold out in New York, you know, we can't keep all of them happy. So we have to turn away a lot of them, unfortunately. We also get a tremendous number of calls for ball pythons. And then probably leopard geckos and bearded dragons are next in line.
Yeah, you know, it's just unfortunate people don't realize that these cute little turtles are like, dollar size or smaller. Mm-hmm. You know, especially the females get, you know, dinner plate size or bigger. It's just,
oh yeah.
They can't grasp that. And then with ball pythons, you know, a lot of people like their docile nature and, like, you know, they're kind of weighty. They don't feel too fragile, like say a young corn snake. But then they realize, you know, not to hate on ball pythons, they're cool and all, but they are hard to make personable. They all have their own personalities, but they're all kind of the same too, you know.
Yeah, they're shy. Yeah. And you know, as you were saying, they're not as active and they feel more substantial. So people like that because they're not, you know, all over the place. Like we get a lot of people that want a corn snake and then they hold one and it's, you know, it's active, it's moving around and they're like, oh, I don't like that. And then they get a ball python. So.
That's so funny. You know, off air, I've talked with Nate about this, but I took my girlfriend and her son for the first time at NARBC in Tinley Park last October. And, you know, she's not fearful of snakes, but, you know, she never really grew up around them. She's always kind of hesitant. And so she had the bright idea in telling me that I'm going to buy a snake here. I was like, okay, babe. Cool. That's going to be your snake, right? She said, oh, yeah. You're going to help me, right, though? I was like, sure. And so, you know, we're looking around. We're seeing corn snakes and king snakes. And she likes those. But it's like, oh, yeah, exactly what you're saying. They're too fast for me. She freaks out a little bit. And then, you know, we get around the ball python dealers. And she's like, oh, my God, these guys are so slow and so cute and docile. And, you know, she pulled the trigger on one. Mm-hmm. A little Herbert, and he's an awesome guy, but I'm taking care of him. He's like my pet.
Yeah, no, I getcha.
And to be frank, I'm just not with it. So unfortunately, we might rehome little filler just because. You know, I'd rather he go to a place to owners that will actually be enthralled and want to care for him. You know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and you know. Work at the rescue as long as I have. I totally get it, and that's the right mentality to have. We see it all the time. Like,
it's like we didn't have to fall into that. I'm telling my gal, we didn't have to fall into that bracket. You made us fall into that bracket.
You made me the thing I hate.
I told you this would happen, but hey, it is what it is.
You know, my take on it is, as long as the person's responsible about rehoming them and they're not just, you know, dumping them on the train tracks, and you know, that's
definitely won't be a rush process, you know.
Right.
You're living in embodiment of the meme. You live either die a hero or live long enough to date someone who makes you a villain.
By association, you're right, Nate.
So,
well, yeah, go on.
Yeah, indigo snakes in particular. What led you into those?
So, going back to my parents buying me all kinds of things, one of the big birthday items I had one year was a encyclopedia that had, they claimed to have all of the snake species that had been discovered by that point. And I thought that the indigo snake page, which at the time it was just Trimacron coriaeus, just one species, I thought they were the coolest. They looked like cobras, which I loved, but I loved the idea that I could meet one and I wouldn't die, because as a child, that's kind of what you're taught. And just reading about them was always just so interesting. And, you know, they were native to the United States, so they were kind of hometown heroes for me. And I just always wanted to see one. And the page of the book that the indigo snakes were on is actually like more worn than all the others, so you could really tell that I was really in when I was small. But I think it's they really defy that phrase, like, you never meet your heroes. And they're such amazing animals. They have such like a gentle confidence to them when you're interacting with them. They're so interesting to handle. They're so intelligent. I use the like the little dog training, like puzzle toys. I've done that with my indigo snakes, and they figure them out, and it's really, really amazing.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of people will relate to it. Like, indigos are definitely a different breed of snake in terms of just their overall confidence, intelligence, quote unquote. I mean, we'll dive into that more on, but you know, it seems like there's more things clicking with them than other snakes.
They're much more visual too. Like they really seem to be looking around and observing visually a lot more than any other snake that I've worked with personally.
And that's partly why we relate to them a bit more. Is, you know, we seem to relate more to critters that are more visually orientated, just like us, because we are as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And plus, you know, when they're really young, and you could speak to this because you know you have a couple younglings. You know, their eyes proportionally are so much bigger when they're young, and then they kind of
Yeah.
their head kind of fills in once they get older, but still relatively they still have relatively big eyes for a snake.
Yeah, definitely. I'd say like larger than a rat snake, but smaller than a racer kind of thing.
Yeah, but even like a big fully grown racer, like yeah, there's no comparison to like a fully grown indigo. So I guess dive in with us with your collection. Like, what are the captives, the species that you harbor right now that you have?
I have five Dry Marcon right now. I have two Mexican indigos, so the rubidus. They are the Guerrero locality, so they have those like really orange throats, and they tend to stay a lot smaller than the other rubidus localities. And then I have two Eastern indigos, a male and female also. They are as unrelated as I could find. Unfortunately, Eastern indigos are plagued with inbreeding, and so I really did my due diligence working to find as unrelated as you really can. It's kind of unfortunately difficult to find ones that are truly completely unrelated at this point. And then I also have a yearling black-tailed crebo, and he is a delight. I love that little snake so much. He's so much fun.
Awesome. I would say the Rubidus really intrigued me, probably because I've seen them a bit in the wild, and just you know, I do like the red phase of them, even though I only see glimpses of those in the wild. And then, yeah, obviously for many people, you know, Cooperi is the cream of the crop, but just like you were saying, you know, unfortunately, you know, they are listed, and you know, obviously you don't want to take more from the wild because they are relatively imperiled snakes, but at the same time, our breeding stock, especially in the US, is pretty not terrible, but it's not the best in terms of genetics.
Yeah. Also doesn't help that it's basically impossible to move across state lines.
Well, I
Yeah,
mean, you
that
have to, yeah, I mean, you have to get a permit and whatnot, but it's just another step for sure for
Yeah, and
them.
I think that step really scares off a lot of people. It's honestly, it isn't too challenging, and it's not that in depth. It's $100, and it takes, or at least in my case, it took a hot minute. It was, I think, 4 months for my first, and then the next year it was about 5 months to actually receive the
Okay,
permit.
I thought the process would have been faster by now because you know I've heard from you know John Michael of Black Pearl Reptiles, you know he's saying the same thing, but that was like years ago, so I'm surprised that it does take a while.
Yeah,
Wait, you're surprised that
the government is inefficient?
it's
Well, let's see for how much longer.
Yeah, it did take a while. It does seem to change a lot because when you look up, just forum posts and whatnot of how long did the process take, it seems to vary so much. I also think that they favor people that already have permits. So if you're getting like another Eastern indigo across state lines, they'll be like, okay, like, and they'll kind of fast track you. That's just what I've heard though. It was not the case for me. So maybe once you're a big name, it becomes a little easier.
Well, now you're here, so apparently it means you're A-main.
Hope so. There's also some states that require ownership permits on top of that, too. New York State being one of them, of course. But it's actually, it's free, which is shocking, because New York State and free don't really, you know,
they go really hand in hand very often.
Yeah. But, yeah. Yeah, so some states have, you know, that barrier also, where you have to, there's another extra step, but then, you know, some people, right or wrong, perceive that as, oh, the government's, you know, going to check on me and look in on my stuff, and that's a turn off for some people too, which I understand. I just tolerate it because I love them so much, so.
Yeah, I mean, that aspect I can totally get. But, you know, I think if you're looking into indigos, I feel like you should already know what comes with the territory of, you know, wanting to own them, especially with the Easterns. So it's like, you know, I think you should already know what to somewhat expect in that aspect.
Yeah, definitely. And it's been the case for so long. Like, it's, you know, they were put on the Endangered Species Act so long ago that it's just kind of become, you know, not common knowledge, but it comes up very early on in your research on if you want one or not.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in just probably like you are, I'm in many Facebook groups specifically for like indigos and dry mark and like, you know, cuprite owners are probably some of the most passionate snake owners out there. You know, every day there's posting photos of their snakes, and I know you are among them as well. And I mean, I don't blame you guys, because they're gorgeous snakes.
Yeah, they're really amazing. And they are, to me at least, they are special. They really interact with you differently than other snakes. I almost like describe my Eastern indigos as like gentle monitor lizards in snake bodies. They're very interactive, very visual based. And like my big male indigo is very food driven, as most of them are. And I kind of conditioned him that when I show him like an open palm, like almost like a high five, that I don't have food and this is just interaction time. And he picked up on that just shockingly quickly. It's, I guess, you know, kind of similar to target training. And it's like, if he's in food mode and he's, you know, reared up and being crazy, I can just show him that open palm and he just calms right down and just comes out and hangs out. So it's really, really a rewarding species to keep.
Yeah, that's a question I was about to ask. People always hear about how alert and attentive dry marken are. So I was going to ask how easy, if there was able to do any sort of training with them. I mean, a lot of snakes you can do target training with, but it sounds like you actually have an actual no food signal, like
right,
an official I come in peace symbol.
I wonder if he'd respond to that too.
Go faster.
I also, for my rubidus, I tend to, they're very shy eaters, so I don't have the same procedures with them. I tong feed my Easterns and my blacktails, but for the Mexican indigos, I honestly just put their food on a paper plate and it's gone an hour or two later. I got my male to tong feed a couple times and then went off for a while and just never got back on tong feeding. So, but
I wonder
if
that's the case with the Mexican locales. You know, I wonder if they're just kind of slightly different than the others.
I do think that that's the case. My Mexican indigos are lovely, but they're definitely not as confident as my Eastern indigos. With especially my female Mexican indigo, I really have to, she's very cage defensive. So, you know, I know a way to get her out, and once she's out, she's great. But if I mess around with her too much, you know, she gets puffy and puffy, and that never is the case with the Eastern indigos. So it is, I think there definitely is a component to their personality. Just Eastern indigos have been in captivity for so long. Like, these lines are so widely, yeah. And, you know, they haven't been wild in so long that I think that kind of contributes to their more gentle, docile personalities.
Yeah. And, you know, I forgot to touch on, you know, since you don't have as big a collection, you know, you named your snakes. So maybe just go through, you know, what the names are of these gentle beasts and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm a huge video game person. I always loved video games growing up. So I named my two female indigos after the dragons from the Zelda series. So they are Nadra and Dinral. And eventually I'm going to have the third one, because there's three dragons from the series. And then their male counterparts are Cassius, my Mexican indigo, and Chaos, my male Eastern indigo. And then my black toe Kribo's name is Falco.
I like it. You know, so obviously Cassius is the one I'm very intrigued in. He has gorgeous eyes. I mean, do you want to just describe for listeners how he looks?
Oh my gosh. I hope that those green eyes are hereditary, because they are just striking to me. I've seen a handful of other Mexican indigos with those same green eyes, but not in person, just on, you know, as you said, Facebook groups and other forums and whatnot. But
are they starting to gain more traction? Or, like, you know, I feel like for the longest, Mexican indigos have just been real under the radar type of subspecies of indigos. And now lately, you know, more and more are starting to be shown and pop out.
Yeah. So I think the Guerrero locality is becoming much more popular, mostly because they stay smaller. People are intimidated by the size of indigos, and the other two main localities of Mexican indigos get way bigger than Guerrero indigos, Guerrero locality, excuse me. So, you know, the Guerrero locality tends to stay around 4 or 5 feet long. And like the Orzeos, for example, they get 8, 9, sometimes, like, you know, that's a bigger commitment, you know, bigger enclosure, more food, you know, bigger snake to deal with on a regular basis. So I think specifically the Guerrero locality rubidus are taking off.
Yeah. And, you know, what's great about blacktails is that you still have that kind of open market where they can, you know, you still get wild stock relatively. Mm-hmm. Is more feasible than all the other ones, obviously, you know.
Yeah, and honestly, I would say yellowtail cribos are still the most wild caught. So they're same kind of deal, and unicolors also. Some people consider them the same as blacktails, but you know, they are technically a distinct subspecies. But yeah, you know, same rules apply. So you can still get them wild caught. My female Mexican indigo was captive bred and imported into the United States in Mexico. So she's kind of an interesting, you know, genetic diversity that I'm not sure is too common here in the United States.
The more the merrier, right? For bloodline wise.
Oh yeah, definitely. And you know, that's, I do hope to, you know, establish breeding projects in the future, but I'm really heavily focused on prioritizing, you know, genetic diversity and health over anything else. Like I'm very grateful that there aren't many morphs and, you know, things like that, like line bred traits and all that, because that doesn't sit right with me. Like I understand, you know, oh, it's so pretty and, you know, colors and stuff, but I kind of prefer like the more natural appearance. You know, not focusing on, oh well, this one's cool looking, you know. So
well, you know, it also seems that indigos are the type of snakes that they don't really, I mean, obviously look at cuprite, they don't seem to tolerate inbreeding as is the case with other snakes. So I would say it's much harder to find that mutation and have it be, I guess, healthy, for lack of a better term.
Or, right.
You know.
Yeah,
and you know, I love wild type.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, honestly, the only consistent morph I can think of that has been prevalent in Dreymarcon at all is the Exanthic blacktail cribos. And otherwise it's locality based, which I love. Like even the I'm not sure if you've seen the red blacktail cribos, instead of gold, they're like a brick red. That's just a locality. That's not a line bred trait. And yeah, I'm all for that, but
would that include the Yucatans? Because I know the Yucatans can get quite red.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I'm referring to.
Oh, man. Yeah. Now, those are probably even rarer than most of the localities we've been talking about. And Just, I mean, people, yeah, I want you guys to look that up after the show. These are gorgeous, gorgeous indigos.
Yeah, they're incredible. And recently Mexico has really cracked down on animal exports also. So those Yucatan locality black-tailed cribos are very difficult to come by in the United States. There aren't that many people working with them, but they are stunning. And they're definitely, I'm on the lookout for them. So,
I mean,
but
they're a higher dollar animal. I mean, I know John Michael. I don't know if he has any hatchlings for this upcoming season, but he's another guy to contact when it comes to different locality of indigos. But yeah, they're up there in terms of being coveted, highly coveted.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's interesting you should mention Guerrero locality indigos, or Mexican indigos coming on, being one of the more popular lines, because Guerrero is right next to Oaxaca, and a certain host of the show has been to Oaxaca and seen some stuff down there.
Yeah, a few times, which is why, it was fascinating to hear you talk about, how the Guerrerans act and are, a little bit less confident, a bit more, not spastic, but I don't know what's the word, just overall,
Lightning.
just not, they don't have the same demeanor as, the bigger conspecifics in the US. And yeah, I would say it probably would have to do with size, because of, I have a small sample size of dry market in the wild, but I had never seen cuprae. I've seen Milanurus in Texas, and then I've seen Rubus a few times in Oaxaca. And kind of similar thing, the Texans, calm as can be, maybe Nate will show later. I found this giant male, 6 footer
Oh,
Texan indigo, and like just I don't know, puppy dog tame is the right word, but I saw it in this grassy patch, and it was like, I don't know if it was on a scent trail. I mean, it was completely oblivious to me, and I just crouched down next to it, and then it finally looked up and it sensed me. I was like, "Whoa!" Because this is like the biggest snake I seen at that date, and then I just kind of just gently scooped him up, and like, yeah, I just wanted to get away, like as any wild snake, and then calm down, and was just tame as can be, like a freaking pet,
Yeah.
but the contrast in Oaxaca is they're much more flightier and biteier. Like, I was surprised that they wanted to bite me as much as they did.
Yeah, and that's I think that's part of why Easterns are endangered is because they are so, just like the Texas indigos, they're so docile that people could just scoop them up in Florida and, keep them in their house and they're lovely little guys and they're not gonna really bite or anything. And I think that's kind of unfortunate for them now because they were collected so heavily for the pet trade.
They were, unfortunately. And yeah, Nate showing the big 6 foot, and
Oh, yeah.
it was a diesel of an indigo.
Yeah, they're big. Like they're very heavy bodied colubrids. And I don't know. It's like holding a steel cable when they get that size.
I'm glad you brought that up too. Just, to describe how indigos feel when you handle them. They can be very stiff and very tense, strong feeling snakes.
Yeah, and from what I noticed, just between the differences of my captive animals, my Mexican indigos are much leaner and they climb a lot
Yes.
more. I keep all my snakes in reasonably large enclosures and give them lots of space to move around and climb on things. And my Mexican indigos are very frequently, up near the top of their enclosure and climbing around on the branches and stuff. And my Eastern indigos, especially my male, because he's so chunky, he doesn't really climb nearly as much and he tends to stay lower to the ground. So
Yeah,
it's a lot
the
different
Texans,
than.
you're not wrong. Yeah, I mean, I'm about to cut you off, but yeah, the Texans and the Easterns definitely seem to be more like diesel, more land tanks in
Yeah.
terms of in indigos. And it seems like, the Mexican and South American conspecifics seem to be a bit more arboreal. I mean, maybe it has to do with them just being in many different habitats as opposed to the ones in the States.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's just something I've noticed just from, I've actually worked with all dry mark cone species except unicolors. I have a friend that has a couple also. And it's the same thing. It seems like the further south in their range you get, like each species gets more arboreal and leaner. So it's very interesting. I'm sure, as you said, it has to do with habitat they're born in and what they've adapted to. But it is fascinating to me that they were all considered the same species at one point.
Yeah, which is wild. You know, giving them such a big geographic range. I mean, obviously there has to be some speciation or subspeciation at some point. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, and you know, it's kind of like rat snake taxonomy. Like, it's such a hot mess. It's like,
it is a bit, yeah.
You know, you can look at the you know, what used to be the eastern rat snake in Florida, and look at the rat snakes up in New York State, and they look completely different and behave differently, but they're the same species. Like, it won't make sense to me, but you know, I'm not a scientist, so can't judge.
Yeah, what can you do? Or like with the unicolor and blacktails, you know, I personally would think they are the same snake, but you know, I just say it's just a phenotypic difference. I don't know.
Yeah, that's kind of my take on it too. But you know, going back, you know, I'm sure there's a difference somewhere that somebody noted, and that's why they're different species. But yeah, to me, like, you know, having interacted with both and seen both in person, they are identical except for the color. So
yeah, it would seem the one that's probably like the odd goose out of the bunch would be the yellowtail. You know, they have a different head morphology. They get the biggest of all the species, and it just seem a bit different. But they do seem to come back to a thicker bill, a more dense bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. But you know, that could also be just because they get so much longer. You know, if my friend's yellowtail crevo is about the same length as my Guerrero male, and they're about the same thickness. So it could just be because they get so long compared to the other snakes that they just kind of, you know, get naturally wider. But I also think it's interesting. Now, I'm sure you guys know already, but there really are only technically three species of indigo snake. The Mexican indigos, Texas indigos, unicolors, and blacktails are all subspecies of Melanaris. So the eastern and the yellowtail are the other two, and they're a distinct species. But
yeah, I'll be real excited in the future academically to see what happens with Primarchan, because you know, it seems like the spotlight for the most part is with Cooperi. And you know, that's great and all, they're imperiled and whatnot, but it'd be nice to see that kind of extensive research and study be allocated to the others, you know?
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. And I'm so sad that the Texas indigo was stripped of its protections too. It still needs those, and I think it's a real shame that they don't have them anymore.
Yeah, I mean, look at Texas. I mean, they're still taking away land just like anywhere else. And you know, it is very sad with the Easterns, because they've had that protection for decades, but have you noticed an increase of abundance or frequencies of observations and sighting? I guess anybody noticed that? Oh, like boots on the ground observation. I personally don't. It doesn't seem like it. So protect the habit. You protect the snake. But all it seems that Florida is concerned with is protecting the snake. And that's not really going anywhere. I personally.
Yeah. You know, you can tell people, you know, all day long, don't kill those snakes, and they won't. But then they build a house on top of their den. And so, you know, it's indirectly killing them anyway. So they are, yeah. It's a real shame. And the gopher tortoise also, the eastern indigo relies so heavily on the gopher tortoise in nature. And people are indiscriminately killing the gopher tortoise because they think it's a rattlesnake den. And that, you know, as a side effect, kills the eastern indigo too, because they rely on the gopher tortoise burrows. So there's just a lot of things working against them, unfortunately.
So I looked up a paper, and apparently, you know, I think Pleistocene era, Easterns ranged all the way up into South Carolina, which is so fascinating to me, you know, to think they ranged that far up north at one point.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about. And I think they ranged into Mississippi at one point also, going west.
Yes.
So, yeah, you know, it's really sad that their range has dwindled so much.
Yeah, I'm just thankful that they are repatriating them in Alabama. So, you know, we'll see in the coming decades to see if that really goes anywhere. But they have been relatively consistent in doing that.
Yeah, that's an awesome sign. You know, I'm hopeful that that's going to continue in that trajectory of just reintroducing them into where they belong, and, you know, in a wider natural range.
And you know, people that at least know a thing or two of snakes that still don't necessarily like them and maybe will still kill many on sight. When it comes to indigos, they do have a little bit more of a notoriety compared to other snakes, especially in Texas, because people will say, oh, that's a blue indigo. You don't kill those. They eat the rattlers and stuff like that. So they do have a bit of that local notoriety. But I mean, it also just depends because, you know, that's also with a generation that saw them more frequently. In Texas and in Florida, and so we're kind of losing that generation, and now people, you know, don't really know what an indigo is, and if they don't like snake, they'll probably still just hack at it anyway. But it's still nice to know. It's nice to know that they don't. There's a notoriety there as opposed to other snakes.
Yeah, and you know, to me, that's great. It is kind of a shame that, you know, they have the notoriety because they kill other venomous snakes. Yeah, it's like, okay, like whatever works for you, however you get there is fine, just as long as you get there. So
Yeah, I've never heard of anyone who hates king snakes. Well, other than Smitty, but
he did resurrect what King Snake Chronicles, so I mean he likes them to some kind of a degree to have a show.
just not Getula.
Yeah, that's another crapshoot as well with those guys. So I'm curious, you know, I brought it to obviously field herping them a little bit. If you were to have the time to field herp and look specifically for a dry Marcon, which of the species, subspecies would you want to look for first, and you know why?
So my guilty favorite is the Eastern Indigo. If it was legal to, you know, find one and touch one in nature, I absolutely would say that. Given the, you know, legalities behind that, though, I probably say that's tough. Probably the one of the Mexican indigos, just because I do think it's fascinating how different they are from each other, and if I had the opportunity to like as you said, see multiple examples of different localities, I think that would be really interesting to me. I also am just a huge sucker for the red throats on the Guerrero localities, so I'd be really excited if I saw one of those in
I mean,
nature.
plus authentic Mexican food. I mean, how can you go wrong? And
Oh,
plus,
man.
especially the tropical states like Guerrero and Oaxaca. Like, just speaking from experience, Oaxaca, I mean, you're rich there with the dollar, and it's delicious, delicious
Oh yeah.
seafood or just local cuisine. So yeah, I highly
I would love that.
encourage. I implore you for sure.
Yeah, I hope to someday.
But yeah, that's a good answer. I mean, Eastern's an iconic snake, so I can see why. And especially when you see like the red throated ones, like the ones you have, which are gorgeous.
Oh, thank you.
So, transitioning more into captive husbandry and care, have you noticed, especially with this cold winter we've had, that they seem to have maybe bed down earlier than normal, or how would you describe their high brumation behavior this far up north outside the range?
So, in my experience, I've had them for 2 winters now. They don't truly brumate like other colubrids. They definitely slow down, and I also, you know, some people might get on me for this. I don't really feed on a schedule. I watch their behavior and base if they want food on that. Also, their body condition. You know, if they're getting chubby, then I kind of cut back. So, over the winter, you know, I feed a lot less, and yes, I would say that they did start slowing down, and they were eating less earlier than normal. Just like we were talking at the very beginning, my bearded dragon went to brumation pretty early this year. I'd say the all the dry Marcon did the same. They kind of started slowing down early, and up in, you know, New York State, our days are shorter than they are in their. And other indigos native environments too. So I think they kind of picked up on that natural light cycle early on. And what I do is I have all my lights on timers, and I just set the timers to go off earlier to kind of replicate the outdoor, like, you know, natural light cycles. So I think I kind of almost encouraged them to slow down a little early this year just because of that.
Yeah. And when do you really start to see them pick up speed in the spring?
Last year.
And that goes for any of your dry market species.
Yeah, so probably like March timeframe. They're starting to kind of be more active now. But my female Mexican indigo might be gravid. So she is kind of hunkering down in her own way at this point. But and I think the pheromones from that are kind of disrupting my others also. They've been more flaky on eating, not the Easterns, but my male Mexican indigo. He used to eat every time, and now he's kind of hit or miss with that. So, okay. Sorry for the long-winded answer, but it's kind of, you know, they're all a little different, I guess. But my blacktail has never slowed down. That little dude will eat anything and do anything all year. So, you know, he's a little different, but.
Which kind of makes sense at that life stage, you know, they're focusing more on growing at that life stage than anything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And all my other indigos are adults, so definitely checks out.
Did you say you had them when they were, my bad, Nate. You said you got them when they were sub-adults, or how young were your others when you got them?
My Eastern indigos, my female was 2 when I got her, and my male was 3. But I got them, you know, some time apart. My male Mexican indigo I got when he was about 1.5 years old, and my female was about 4. And I got my little blacktail cuivo when he was like just a couple months old.
Nice. So you have like a decent range of kind of age groups with them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm really happy I did it that way, because I really feel that younger snakes are much more challenging in a lot of ways. And I'm glad that I started with an older snake, because I could kind of learn their habits without dealing with like the baby flightiness and all that. And and I've just had a really interesting experience with each of them. They're all very different personality wise.
I mean, do you mean like with Falco, is that kind of what you're talking about, with some of the apprehension with having them as like hatchlings or whatnot?
Yeah, when I first got him, and he was just, I think he was about 4 or 5 months old, he was pretty flighty, but he never skipped food, which was great. but now he's super calm, and I can just, you know, reach in and he just comes right out. My Eastern indigos, just, you know, straight out the gate, super sweet, super docile. Like when I took my Eastern out of the shipping box, he was just like, oh, hey, like, oh. You know, it's so easy.
Yeah, which is, again, not common for most snakes at all, you know, so there's quite a difference with indigos. I guess now we could touch on a little bit on their personality. I mean, they're all different with different individuals, but touch on like maybe their personalities and say their quirks or say intelligence, like examples of what they've shown you.
Yeah, so I mentioned it briefly before, but the dog food, like, training puzzles, like, you know, if you like move this lever, you get a treat. And they seem very engaged with those. And, I love them, but if you put like a black rat snake in front of one of those, it would just, the snake would get frustrated and, you know, eventually just give up. But the indigos really seem to be engaged with problem solving, and, you know, they really try to move the levers and knobs and open up the little action, all that with the food item in there. I also really love giving them quail eggs. It's fascinating watching them figure out how to consume the egg. because the indigo jaws don't stretch like a lot of other snakes do. So watching them try to like break the egg without like hurting themselves is really is like really interesting. And I have to put it in like a big dish because they get so excited it makes like the biggest mess ever in their enclosures. But it's just very interesting watching them try to figure out how to eat things. And my male Eastern indigo figured out how to open his quarantine enclosure within like 48 hours of owning him. So that was fun. Yeah, it was a like a sliding door, you know, standard.
Wow, enclosure. Really?
Yeah, and he always like watched me open and close it. And then I had a lock on it, but I was sitting there and like the second or third day I had him, I was watching him put his nose right where like the handle is on the other side of the glass and like sliding his nose to the side. It was just very interesting. And so I'm glad I had the lock on there.
I guess they're kind of like the raptors from Jurassic Park, Nate.
I was going to say, that'd be terrifying. Just walking up late at night, now I'll get a drink of water, something like that. And you go into your kitchen, all of a sudden there's a 6-foot indigo just going like, hello, mother. I have figured out doorknobs.
You know, I wouldn't put it past him.
That's really impressive. That's so cool. I'm curious with going back to the quail eggs, you know, with the indigos I've experienced, I know they can be kind of loud breathers. And especially when they get excited, do they do that huffing like when they're yes. excited?
Yeah.
I love that noise.
It's so awesome. And it's very different than their hiss too. So it's definitely like an excitement thing, not a fear thing. And my
they just start hyperventilating.
It's almost like a dog panting in some ways. Yep.
It sounds like an asthmatic dog. But you know, my Eastern indigos, when I take them, I like to take them outside too, because they really enjoy being outside. They get so huffy when they're outside. Like they're just so active and alert to like everything going on. Yeah, that too. You know, I provide UVB to my snakes, but yeah, nothing beats the sunlight. So they love being out there. Unfortunately, we got a huge ice storm today, so
yeah,
going outside today. But in the spring and cooler days in the summer and the fall, I take them outside all the time.
That's great. That's awesome.
So which would you say has been your favorite species of Dromarchon on to work with?
I mean, I think it's Easterns for sure. Definitely my guilty favorite. I just think that their personalities are just so unique. And you know, Texas indigos I've heard are similar, but I don't have one personally, so I'm gonna say Easterns.
Okay.
Yeah. And it seems that Texans seem to be more common than Easterns nowadays. And I feel like, you know, I don't necessarily know, I have to research, but I think they have also overall a bigger gene stock as opposed to Easterns.
Yeah, I would definitely say that's the case. And I think the reason that Texas indigos are more popular, and or I should say more common, is that there aren't those legality barriers. There's no permits required, and they're just, you know, they're easier to find. Like I've seen Texas indigos at some local reptile shows I've been at, and never seen an Eastern indigo.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of touching on price, it seems like Easterns have held, you know, the same price point for pretty consistently for a number of years. It seems like the Texans and the Crelos have kind of gone up in price in the coming years. I remember a Texan was like $400. Now, you know, they're more in the eight, nine range. You know, is that kind of your experience? It seems like all the other subspecifics have gone up in price, but now are kind of steady at that kind of sub or above a grand.
Yeah, I would definitely say that's the case. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. First off, it's you know, simply they have relatively small clutches of eggs. So there aren't that many snakes being produced every year by dry Marcon breeders. Just supply and demand stuff. And a wild caught is becoming less common since Mexico has, within the last, decade, I would say, kind of tightened up on exports. A lot of the more common, if you will, species of dry Marcon are just not, there's no wild caught stock available, or not as much. I think the last thing is that people look at the Eastern indigo as one of like the kings of the colubrids, right? Like they're held at a very high prestige. And when people hear indigo snake, most default to the Eastern indigo. And I think because Eastern indigos are, more difficult to find, they're the licensing and permits and all that, I think people will just jump to the closest alternative, which is in a lot of cases like the Texas indigos and really any dry Marcon. So I think just because the Easterns are held in such a high regard, people kind of attribute that to other dry Marcon, not wrongfully, but.
No, again, yeah, they are probably the most coveted of a group. And so they've held that high price point for so long. Mm-hmm. With the other subspecifics, I'm curious, we never touched on this, but are dry Marcon your first snakes you got into keeping captively? Like, were there any previous snakes that you had or got into besides your ball python?
Yeah, so I got my ball python first, but only by a couple months. My Eastern indigo was I think it was about 3 months after I have been keeping my ball python.
So that's kind of what I'm alluding to. So you basically did your research and then you jumped into dry Marcon, which is again really impressive from your standpoint.
Thank you.
These are not, I don't like the term beginner snake, but you know what I mean. For these groups of snakes, you would have to do your research. You would have to know what you're getting into because they're a different kind of snake.
This comes from the guy who got a Chinese king rat right off the bat.
And so, again, I'm glad you looped that for us, Nate. When it comes to big colubrids, we're all big colubrid fans here. And it usually, I would say, of those, I would say the top three would be, dry Marcon, indigos and crebos, falsies, false water cobras. And then, for third place, I would say it would be king rat snakes or something along those lines. The only caveat I would say with king rat snakes is that because they are found in more temperate environs, they're a lot, I think they're more manageable as a big colubrid than the others because their metabolism isn't as fast. They definitely have a dormancy period as opposed to the others. And I think that's the main differences. And they're slower growing, so you're able to adjust accordingly at a less accelerated rate compared to like dry Marcon. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I'm so with you on the beginner species thing. I personally feel that if you do your research and your due diligence and you have, if you've really like done the legwork and are passionate about it, almost anything can be a quote beginner species. I think that it's bad when someone wants to get, let's just Brazilian rainbow boa, right? And people are like, I really want a Brazilian rainbow boa. And somebody says, oh, well, that's a really hard species. You should get a ball python first. And they're like, okay. And then they get a ball python and it's not what they want. And the ball python then, not neglected per se, but it's not what the person is passionate about. But, I'm a very strong proponent of, just do your research and test things out. You know what you're parameters and husbandry should be. Put some sensors in there, months before you get the snake. Make sure everything's worked out, your community's good, the temps are good and all that. And the snake's not going to change the temperature of the enclosure. Like if you can get it with the enclosure empty, it's put the snake in, it's not going to change. So that's all I did with my dry Marcon was, I set up their enclosures and tested everything so rigorously for so long. And and then just kind of jumped into it.
And you know, we could, were you going to go next?
No.
And I guess touching on husbandry a little bit, I would say with the nice thing about dry Markham, they really don't like, I guess, excessive heat. So, I mean, in your experience, like ambient, say, I mean, no, how about you lead that. So what would you say ambient and then hot spot would be for these guys? Because I know it's kind of on the lower end for what people would expect for a big colubrid.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you alluded to, they really don't like high temps. Anything above 85, they are extremely uncomfortable. So I keep mine in, you know, reasonably large enclosures. So I do a gradient. They have a hot spot of like low 80s, I would say. And by the cool side, it's, you know, mid 70s. And they definitely do a lot of back and forth throughout the day. I personally provide UVB to my snakes, and they definitely utilize that also. So I have UVB over their basking lights and whatnot. But I, you know, turn all lights off at night, and I change temps kind of seasonally also. So in the winter months, I actually turn their hot spots way, way down, and the ambient temps fall naturally too, just because we're in New York. So, you know, it's at night, like high 60s in their enclosures. Sometimes, you know, fall a little lower than that if we get a particularly cold day. But I have pretty extensive, you know, sensors that are hooked up to my phone, and if it gets too hot or too cold, I get like alerts and stuff. But honestly, the temps for dry Markham are extremely easy as long as it's not too hot. That's their main thing. So.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a great pointer, great pro for them, you know, as opposed to say, you know, falsy, which they kind of fall in the same range, maybe needing a bit more humidity. But, you know, if you have them dropping below 70 for too long, as Dr. Loffman would say, you start to run into digestion issues and whatnot. And with king rat snakes, they're kind of along in the same vein with Fred Markin, where they really don't like it that hot. They actually prefer it much cooler. And again, they have a slower metabolism, which is just so funny because, you know, dry Markham, you can allude on this, you know, they have pretty fast metabolisms for a snake.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll get into the dirty details on that, but it is quick. So.
Yeah. Like you say, you don't really follow the schedule, which I love as well. I kind of follow the same principle, but still, what would you say? Say maybe a 2-week basis, how often would you feed them? Like 3 times, 4 times?
In the summer, in a 2-week period, I probably feed roughly 3 to 5 times. They eat and poop it out within typically two to three days, and they're ready to eat again after that. So, but in the winter, I usually feed them probably roughly once a week, like once every 1 to 10 days. So it's a very substantial difference. Again, with the exception of my baby or yearling, he eats pretty much the same. But I also don't let his temps fall as low as the adults. So I keep him a little bit higher. I still give him like a cool down in the winter, but not as extensive.
And then obviously water is really important for these guys.
I have never seen a snake drink more water than my Eastern indigos. It's insane how much water they drink compared to my other snakes. I'm changing their water at least once a day. They're also just so active that they kick substrate into the water all the time. So, you know, I'm just changing it a lot naturally. My female Eastern indigo also really enjoys pooping in her water bowl, which yes, let's pollute your source of life, but so I have to clean her water a lot too.
So what do you choose to use for substrate?
I use a topsoil and sand mix. I do have plants and isopods in my enclosures also, but
that probably helps out a little bit.
It does, but I 100% spot clean every single time. They produce so much waste that it would be like unethical to leave it there. So I take out huge like clump of dirt and all of the waste every single time. And not to get graphic, but it's very runny, and so you know you can't get out of it. And the isopods kind of take care of the rest. So
I can just imagine those poor isopods at the end of the week, just like, I'm tired, boss.
The floodgates keep opening.
Oh, that's a too literal of a description, I think.
So I don't want to battle you, but another pro for the king rat is that they poop less often, and I like you, kind of have a pseudo bioactive enclosure, and so the ice pods really do take care of it. I still spot clean here and there, but mm-hmm. obviously not as often. You know, I have a hatchling myself, and so
I love
king rat. King rat. Yeah, they are great looking, especially the Taiwan locality.
I'm not familiar with those.
They're the ones that look more like king cobras. They don't really have black and yellow coloration.
Oh, they're more. Are they more like almost like off?
More tan. Like,
okay. Yeah.
Tan, cream, beige type of coloration. They're really cool looking. I just got the typical black and yellow, but even I find mm-hmm. that. I mean, I think black and yellow, just like black and red, is just one of those color combinations that's so appealing to our monkey brains.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I love king rats too. They're amazing snakes to work with. My friend has a pair of king rats as well. And they're special too. Yeah, they're different, but they definitely command respect in ways that a lot of bluebirds don't. So I'm a big fan of theirs as well.
Yeah, I mean, I would say they're definitely a lot more introverted as opposed to Jamaican, especially like the Easterns. But yeah, you know, they're very visual. You know, they have quite big eyes, and they look mm-hmm. at you quite intimately, or like deep into your soul type of stare.
Yeah, you know, like when you're looking at them, they look back kind of thing.
Yeah, which is the same with, you know, Jamaican. You know, you look at them and you really think you guys are both clicking, which mm-hmm. you don't necessarily get or feel from other serpents.
Yeah, 100% agree. I haven't had the opportunity to work with any false water cobras, but I've heard that they're the same way. Unfortunately, they're very difficult to keep in New York State because there's licensing around them as well. So it's definitely a snake that I would have if I felt like dealing with the dangerous animal permits, but it's a pain. So,
man, you like the fast snakes. The fast metabolism snakes.
Oh, yeah, unfortunately.
I just love the smell of snake poo in the morning.
Oh, man.
Musk enchanté.
I also I have a toke gecko also. And so I get the noises of him at night, and then sometimes the smells of poops. And yeah, it's an interesting room. So.
Sounds like a cacophony of interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are some other herps that you haven't kept but you really want to work with?
A monitor of some kind. I love monitor lizards. But going back to like what we said kind of early on, I think lizards are just so much more work. And I just don't currently have the time or space for a monitor. I'm fortunate to be able to work with them at the reptile rescue because we do get them every now and then. But having my own, especially, I'm very infatuated by tree monitors.
What's the most common that you would see in the rescues?
Savannah monitors, for sure.
Yeah, it makes sense.
You know, I've definitely seen less of them now, which is, I think, a plus at the shows. But it's still surprising. They still come in droves, and they're still surrender so often.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're so inexpensive at expos, and they shouldn't be, but you know, if somebody looks at, you know, this little, what, 6-inch long lizard that's $25, they'll be like, oh yeah, that's great. And then, you know, once it's 2 feet long and angry and fat because it's not getting the right diet, then it's, you know what, the hassle, and then they get surrendered. So really, I think the price point is their detriment.
Yeah, I mean, they all get aged prematurely and then develop gout, and then like, you know, just liver disease, and they die so early, and it's a real shame, because mm-hmm. they're a great size for a monitor if you don't want like a Acanthurus, if you don't want a spiny tail mm-hmm. or a rich tail monitor. But yeah, it's just people don't know what they don't know about them. For the longest, yeah. they thought like grounded up turkey was the best diet for these guys, and
oh yeah, and like dog food and stuff, man.
Yeah.
Oh. And
yeah, but monitors are cool. But it's funny, you're kind of halfway there with keeping dry marking.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if monitors were as chill, they would be so similar. You know, not to say that you know all monitors are crazy, but I've definitely worked with more difficult monitors than sweet ones. So
yeah, they just seem to be more of a high strung group of lizards.
Mm-hmm. Very food driven too.
Yeah. So I know I did send a few photos to Nate of the rubulus I found, mainly the one I found the latest trip. So I'm curious, when you were looking for, you know, the Guerrero locality, did you ever see the black and white phase?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
I didn't personally go for those because they do just get so much larger. And I wanted a more compact Trimarchon, if you will. So just a little easier for me to handle.
Yeah, I just only asked that because, you know, I typically just see, you know, the red phase ones. So when I saw these in the wild, I was kind of taken aback. I didn't know they got so white like this, like high white like this. And it was surprising. I'm more partial to the red phase, but they both look gorgeous, as you were probably going to say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 100%. No, I have nothing against them. It was just, with the space that I have, it just wasn't practical. So hopefully in the future, though, I do hope to have different localities of the rubidus. Did you take that picture?
That's on. Yeah. So these are.
That's a gorgeous snake.
Yeah, so this is the biggest one I've seen. In my travels to Oaxaca, I've seen roughly four indigos. One got away, which the one that got away, interestingly enough, was a really interesting coloration. It was like a big golden and red, so I would have loved to have grabbed that one.
But oh, yeah, that would have been really neat.
Of all the other ones I've seen, there was just the black and white face. And this one that I'm showing, it was the largest. It was about 5 feet, but you know, it's kind of like you're describing that they are a leaner build kind of indigo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I would say, and yeah, you could tell that just looks so much more leaner than say a Texan or Eastern of that size.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Still a very impressive snake though. That's a beautiful snake.
Yeah. That was my friend Emiliano that joined me. That was his first indigo. And it's, you know, quite right for him because he is from Mexico. Not from Oaxaca, but he is from Mexico. So it's nice to get him his lifer to be a Mexican indigo.
Yeah, that's amazing. That must have been really exciting.
Yeah. It's funny. We, you know, I did some prior research. And so there were some areas that I knew indigos occurred in. And so the first day herping wise, we went to this one national park on this one specific trail that's kind of transitory from like a dry rainforest to xeric shrub type habitat, coastal xeric shrubland. Mm-hmm. And you know, we were walking for a good couple of hours, and then I heard rustling right behind me. And then there's just stretched out indigo, and then it was just on the go. And I've been faster in my life. I went through brumbles. I got fired by a few cacti, but it was well worth it. And I made the dive and I got the snake. And I mean, that's all that mattered in the end.
Oh, that's really
awesome. You know, like I said, it was a bit more biter than I'm used to with dries, but after a while it calmed down and just kind of mm-hmm. went into curiosity mode. It's like, what is this creature? It's not eating me, so what is it? You know, it just looked at me and whatnot.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Like, I've always heard that, you know, Easterns and Texans are pretty docile, but that's cool to learn that the Mexican indigos kind of acted the same way.
Yeah, like a little feistier from the get-go, but after a while, just kind of get back to that same curiosity mode.
Yeah.
Yeah, Brian, you have any other questions?
I think I'm good on my end. How about you?
Well, we do have the one last question to ask. So, what's one place in the world that you haven't gone herping to that you want to go herping the most?
That's a really good question. Honestly, probably Australia. I just think that
Nice.
there's so many just fascinating snakes there, and like the different localities of carpet pythons are fascinating to me, and I love Antaresia, and I would love to see like wild Antaresia, and I would like to think that if I came across one of the like tiger snakes or eastern brown snakes or whatever, I would know what to do and not get bit by it and just be allowed in its presence and just be fascinated by it. I don't know. That's gonna be my answer, but there are so many places I would love to go. And unfortunately I haven't really had too many opportunities to go herping. My most recent, I was along the Hudson River, found like 900 northern water snakes, but something more exotic would be cool too.
Hey, Nerodia, you can't beat Nerodia just in terms of quantity for sure.
Oh yeah. It
Yeah.
was a real sunny day. They were all out on the rocks basking. It was really
Yeah.
cool. There was one that had eaten, it must have been like a bluegill or something with like the more diamond-shaped body, because it had the goofiest like lump in its body. I left that one alone, but it was funny to look at.
It's insane how they're able to just stress their jaws over prey with such a mass. You're like, how do you down this thing?
Yeah, it's wild. It looks
Yeah.
like it ate like a waffle or something.
A spiny waffle.
Yeah, that
It's unreal. But good choice with the Land of Oz. I mean, you're our first guest that said that. I mean, it's a proper country continent to go herping in. And like the carpets, we all love carpets here. And then even scrubs, because there's something
Oh,
about
yeah.
scrubs. There's something about scrubs that they're almost similar in a way to, I would say they're almost like the Dreadmarken of the Python world. Them and like retics and just turn and just how they are.
Yeah, the way that they interact with people is different than other pythons, I've noticed.
Yeah. Obviously, once you get past the bitey phase, I see you, Nate,
Yeah.
giving me eyes.
All right. Well, how can people get in contact with you if you want them to?
Yeah, so my Instagram is at darker scales, all one word. That's where I primarily post content. I'm on Facebook too, but not really too active there, but definitely Instagram.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. It was great talking with
Yeah,
you.
this was awesome.
All right. See you next time. Bye.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Ciao, guys. But even